Sharko Lounger.
No, that's not. You wouldn't. If somebody said Sharko Lounger, you wouldn't. You wouldn't think, oh, Barco Lounger.
Yeah, that's right. probably true.
Barco like, Sharder.
What would help here is if there was a word that meant poop that sounded like bark. I'm Zach.
I'm Riff.
And I'm Kevin.
And it's time for another episode of Video Games Hot Dog. How's it going, guys? How was your Thanksgivings?
Have we not recorded a show since Thanksgiving?
No, I don't think so. I think it was prior to Thanksgiving was our last recording.
Wow, yeah. I don't even know how time works anymore.
How was your Thanksgiving, Kevin?
It was good. I was on the East Coast briefly. Had Thanksgiving dinner with Melissa's family, which was always nice.
Did you get high and eat stuffing off of the blades of a helicopter?
I did not.
is that a thing?
Melissa's dad is a stoner helicopter repairman.
Oh,
yeah, machinist.
He's like the guy in the Maytag commercials. Higher and helicopters instead of washing machines.
I wouldn't have thought of that Maytag guy as being a stoner.
Really? The Dunkin' Donuts guy, though, definitely.
That's why
he doesn't like to get up early in the morning. He was up all night being high.
I thought ancient Maytag peoples had to get high in order to catch their game, which was Maytag machines. Is that not a thing?
Okay. Is there some anthropology joke that I'm missing where there was some ancient species that had to get high in order to hunt?
Well, I don't know.
Was that invented the washing machine?
I don't know that they are ancient. There are definitely quasi-contemporary societies where hunters will get high because they're just sort of waiting for long, long periods of time doing nothing. And so smoking weed or the local equivalent helps them deal with.
I know. In Central America, you hear about them chewing on the coca leaves.
Like when Papillon was in
the middle of escaping, they said, "Hey, chew on this," and he was like, "Fuck yeah! Now I can drink 12 more beers, brah." That's what Papillon said. Hold on, guys, I have a plan.
Coca has like amazing anti nausea induced from altitude sickness properties.
Oh yeah, because you had some once, right?
Yeah, because I was in Bolivia for a while, and which is at like 15,000 feet, and I was pretty sick from the altitude, and had a bunch of coca tea and chewed on some coca leaves, and it cleared that right the fuck up. It was kind of awesome.
Did you pick them right out of the ground?
I did not pick them out of the ground.
Was it that it cleared up your dealer's fanny pack? Or just fixed you so that you did not care?
It cleared up the sickness.
Well, with
Because I was still winded, just like climbing stairs and stuff. It is amazing how different it is until you acclimate.
So when we did our the only high altitude trip that I've ever been on with you, I mean, apart from some airplane rides that we've taken, none of our party actually experienced any severe altitude sickness.
Yeah,
right? I mean, we were all unhappy with the level of windedness that we had, and it was like, fuck, why is this so hard?
Yeah,
man,
I think headaches and stuff don't tend to set in unless you're spending significant time. Well, I mean, it depends. It varies for everybody. I think that might just be like a white blood cell count kind of thing. And I think it starts to set in more as you get further and further above like 12,000 feet. I think we were only briefly above 13 or 14,000 at the most.
I mean, I was listening to the White Stripes, White Blood Cells the whole time on my iPod.
That probably helps. That's
why it didn't hit me as hard. Yeah, I mean, I guess our trip was only, we would go up that high and then go down.
Yeah.
As opposed to having the whole thing like, oh, we're just walking across a salt flat, but it is a salt flat on the moon. Do you think they have salt on the moon?
If they do, it's probably flat.
Kevin, so you spent Thanksgiving with Melissa's family in Boston.
Yes.
And then I derailed the entire conversation about getting high.
It was actually in New Haven, and then I went up to Boston for a couple days to hang out with mostly some of Melissa's old college friends.
How did it compare to Old Haven?
I've never been to Old Haven, but I hear it's kind of run down. So
did you go to New Salem?
I went to regular Salem. There's Salem in Massachusetts, and there's Salem in New Hampshire, and I've been to both. Salem
Which
in
one
New
had
Hampshire
the witch trials?
Has witch trials was in Massachusetts. Salem in New Hampshire has kind of an interesting set of like creepy rock formations, sort of like a mini Stonehenge, or like a I would maybe even a larger Stonehenge because
like a midget to dance around.
Well, it's like.
Like naturally occurring though?
It was done by people. It's these swaths of trees were cut out of the forest in line with the like where the sun is on the solstice, I think, or maybe the equinox. Probably the solstice because that's where it's like at the extremes. And so like on that one day out of the year, the sun will set down this like sort of alleyway of trees, and there's like stone formations around and stuff. It's pretty neat. I think they've been artificially continuing to cut down the trees in that row since it was discovered, so that it continues to be a thing to draw tourists.
But you weren't there on the solstice.
I was not, no. And that was also like years and years ago. This was I went to Salem most recently. And when I went to Salem this most recent time, I was mostly hungover because I had been drinking very much and very late the night before. So,
you know what's good for a hangover?
More
mounds and mounds of cocaine.
Oh, probably.
I was going to suggest either witch's brew or salt.
Oh, okay. Ergot applied vaginally via broomstick.
Oh,
Jesus.
I'm assuming that would give you that thing where you don't give a fuck about your hangover anymore because you're hallucinating fires in the sky and shit.
Probably true.
And Wicker Man and Nicolas Cage asking you where the bees are and shit. Yeah, I don't know. It's not going to bring
you. How did the toast get burned?
Back. Yeah.
Yep.
What did you do for Halloween, Riff? Just going to go with it.
It's been long enough that I don't remember. Actually, I don't think I did anything on Halloween. I turned off the porch light.
No. What about Thanksgiving?
Nothing special. Jenny and I cooked some food and ate too much food and watched some cartoons.
What cartoons?
We watched some Adventure Time.
Good.
Yeah.
You didn't watch a Pilgrim's Progress or anything? The animated version?
Nothing like that. Season 4 of Adventure Time, just the last few days, came out on iTunes in HD, which was what I was waiting for before buying them and watching them.
Our friend Josh
is... the young John Wayne Chronicles, where he calls everybody pilgrim because they are actually pilgrims.
No.
Also, John Wayne lived about 200 years.
Yeah.
So John Wayne's character, when he was young, was actually among the pilgrims.
Our friend Josh of Horror Show Hot Dog is not really sold on Adventure Time, and I have not watched it, so I'm
yes.
curious what your thoughts are on the show.
Josh will look at a series of 500 jokes, and if one of them is a fart joke, he will conclude that he has just seen a series of 500 fart jokes.
Yeah.
I don't know what it is, man. Something about farts just resets his humorometer.
Huh. Plus, the first episode of Adventure Time, the second half of it is all Lumpy Space Princess, and Lumpy Space Princess is an acquired taste.
Oh, I acquired it right away.
I'm warming up to her, but that first one is a lot to take all at once.
But they go to Lumpy Space. There is a quasi dimension, like, because she is not a space princess who is lumpy. You find out early on that she is a princess of Lumpy Space.
Huh.
I don't know, man. I kind of feel like Adventure Time is just a perfect reflection of the culture I inhabit.
I feel like if this were a different universe where instead of making Kingdom of Loathing, we were doing a cartoon, it would be that cartoon or very similar.
Not Family Guy.
No.
Man, I read some really bad reviews of a Family Guy Return to the Multiverse.
The cartoon or the video game.
But I'm tempted to... I was going to buy it just so that I could play it and try to enjoy it. To give a comparing
even,
and contrasting
even the
view.
People who say they really like Family Guy hated that game.
It was $50, though. Wow. I wasn't going to pay $50 for it. I will wait until it is $1, and then I will buy it and try very hard to enjoy it. I went with a video games taco commentator, Emily, and my mother, who, as far as I know, has never been on any podcasts or played any video games since Dr. Mario. We went to Las Vegas, and we had a good time. I discovered something insidious.
Oh, yeah?
I discovered that the ATMs at all of the casinos on the Strip now, when you withdraw money, in addition to charging you a fee, it charges you an additional percentage of the transaction.
Whoa!
To withdraw money from it.
How much of a percentage?
How big?
At the hotel that we stayed at, it was 4%. The lowest one that I found in my just spot checking was 2.95%.
Wow.
Yeah.
Are there casino ATMs that waive the transaction fee if you get your money in chips?
Ooh, that'd be a pretty good scheme. I went up to the window and I was like,
extra 20s. You're like, woohoo!
Oh, yeah, that'd be pretty good. I went up to the cashier and I said, hey, so I noticed that your bullshit ATMs charge a transaction percentage in addition to the normal fee. Is there any way for me to get some money to gamble here? And they said, well, you can open up a line of credit, which will involve us doing a credit check on you. And I said, well, no, I don't want to do that. I just want some dollars. He's like, well, you can also fill out a form to apply for our check cashing program. And I said, could I do that just knowing my account number and my routing number? No, you need a physical check.
Physical. Turn your head and
call. You need to take it. You need to get a physical. And I had to explain to them, I'm sorry, I don't have my checkbook. I left it in the glove compartment of my covered wagon. Yeah, I don't know. So that sucked. I did. Don't worry, guys. I found a Walgreens with an ATM that only charged a $3 transaction fee, and then I didn't gamble at any of the casinos on the Strip that had those percentage fees. I went to a casino on the Strip, did not look at any of the ATMs, and gambled at it so that I could, in good conscience, maintain my boycott. Which I guess is a little disingenuous.
Do you think
you really think about it,
the casino owners are getting that percentage, or do you think that it is the ATM owners being particularly aggressive?
Or it is a third party thing? ATM company, according to the cashier at the Wynn. He said the casino does not own those, and I noticed that a lot of the ATMs from casino to casino had exactly the same sort of typefaces and interface printing and stuff. So I think that there is some consortium. I think it's the gnomes of Zurich. Yeah. Also, I need to learn how to say Zurich.
I wonder if they have to be particularly heavy duty ATMs because people are more likely to steal them, or something. Because Vegas, they're probably more full of money than other places.
I think that people are categorically less likely to steal something from a casino floor than they are from any other location in the world.
I don't know. I mean, I've watched Ocean's 11 a bunch of times. So.
There was that Ocean's 11 Breaking Bad crossover where those meth heads stole they mounted an 11 man heist to steal an ATM from a casino floor. It's like you realize that this ATM was next to a room that had like millions and millions of dollars in it, right, guys? Yeah, that's cool. I'm hungry. I mean, I'm not hungry. I haven't been hungry in weeks. I don't remember what meth is like.
You remember.
So I went to, we went down to Fremont Street on the last day after Thanksgiving, and I played a bunch of craps, which I enjoyed a lot. A craps table is fun. If you actually kind of learn how the betting works in craps, it is a way to sit around a table, lose some money fairly slowly, and really feel like you know what you're doing. Because everybody that walks up behind you is like, man, I don't understand this at all. And you turn around and think, you know what? I used to be just like you, buddy. But then I spent 15 minutes learning how this works. And now I'm having fun. And I'm fist bumping strangers when the dice are going our way. And I'm going, oh, and looking wistfully into the eyes of strangers when the things aren't going our way.
Were you ever the shooter?
Craps are your best odds in a casino if you know how to play, too.
Everybody gets to shoot.
Do they?
If you stay at the table long enough, you get to shoot. I had one fairly good run where I made everybody a bunch of money, and then I had a couple runs where I crapped out right away. It's pretty fun, though. I recommend it. It is a very social experience. It makes me feel like maybe that is what people get out of watching sports.
Huh.
Although, man, the family that we met there, they were a bunch of football fans, and we couldn't do anything at all until some goddamn college football game was over. That they were sitting in recliners at the sports book at one of the casinos, just watching a goddamn college football game on the television. And then when the underdog won, they were all like, "Yay, we win $9 for every $11 we bet." And I was like, "Wait, what the fuck?" If they were not pegged to win, how did they not pay better than 2-1? Like, it seems like you would take the house cut out of the better odds rather than the worse ones. But maybe you take it out of each of them independently.
I mean, excited about losing $2 for every $11 that you put down on something seems odd too. I mean, maybe they didn't.
I think maybe you took me a little too literally, Kevin.
I don't know. But like, maybe it's that maybe they didn't vote on the right spread of score or something to get the better than even odds. I don't know.
Yeah,
or were
you
joking that they were losing money? I don't even know what's happening now.
No, it paid $9 in addition to their original.
Go to a casino, bet some money that I'm going to lose this money.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty good. Oh, man. Fucking sport, man. And then, like, at the sports book, there are these, like, LED screens with all of these fucking numbers on them and the names of teams. And I asked a handful of people that were sitting around there, engaged in what was going on and with money at stake. I'm like, what do any of these numbers mean? And all of the people were like, man, I don't know. It's just like that there'll be like the name of a team and then something that might be a score and then some numbers that are either positive or negative. And I don't know if some of those are like, because I mean, in football, there'll be like point spreads. Like you don't win your bet on a team unless it wins by a certain amount. Because I think in certain cases, there are games that are just statistically kind of a foregone conclusion. And so you find the thing that is closest to 50-50 odds of happening, you know, according to the odds makers.
Right.
Who are, I am assuming, a conclave of wizards on top of a mountain somewhere with every television.
And their leader, Nate Silver.
Sure, yeah. He knows who's going to get the 343. I don't remember what that number is on his website.
538.
538?
Okay. Yeah. What I want to go back to the statement that you made about craps providing the same kind of, I don't know, social engagement that people derive from sports. And I want to dig into that a little bit. Like, what did you mean by that?
Well, so there was a group of strangers standing around this table.
Yes.
And there was a thing happening that in the short term and in the limited scope of the amount of money that we had at stake at this table sort of joined our fates. And okay. So when a good thing happened, we were all happy in a very like collective way. Like, okay. this would have been a case where
you're talking about like going to a sports bar with a group of strangers and you're all rooting for the same team. It sounds like.
Right? Yeah. Like when we're in a bar and we're like just trying to drink and have like a 2 or 3 person conversation about video games, which is what always happens when we're at a bar. And there's a sports game on the television, and suddenly the entire bar just erupts into joyous shouting goal! Because of something that happened at the sports game. That is always a thing where I'm like, I wish I had friends. And then you guys are like, fuck you, you do have friends. What are we, chopped liver?
I wish I could know sports.
But yeah, I don't know. I mean, there were just a number of times where, like, high fives were exchanged between strangers at this table.
Okay.
You know? And it wasn't like, it almost felt like, I'm like, wow, fuck, if these people are this happy when the dice are coming up good for us, what's going to happen when this takes a downturn? Like, there are going to be some fucking stabbings at this table.
Imagine,
and I need to not be next to the crazy guy.
Imagine what goes on if there's that one guy at the table betting the don't pass line.
Man, that fucking happened. Okay. All right. So there is a way there is a way to walk up to a craps table and become a fucking villain.
Yep.
And that is to go up to a craps table and start making the bets that pay off if the shooter fails.
Okay.
And, yeah, and man, this old guy who was either somehow cognitively deficient or, and I think this is the more likely case, just really, really drunk. He walked up with like a lot of money, like thousands of dollars worth of chips in his hand, and was very carelessly placing a lot of very unpopular, very high stakes bets against the people. But he kept fucking it up. Like, he kept putting the chips in the wrong place. Like, he kept holding up the game while the dealers tried to explain to him what he needed to be doing. And so everybody's kind of pissed off at him for that. And then everybody's even more pissed off at him for betting against us. Right? Even though it probably is... The thing about craps is kind of like a slightly disguised version of the thing about roulette, which is that every bet pays exactly as much as it takes to disadvantage you.
Yeah.
Right? Every payoff is based on being slightly worse than the odds of the thing that pays happening. And so it isn't any more or less rational to bet against the people throwing the dice or the people not, you know, or betting for them. Right. Because I'm sure they pay off. They
camaraderie
paid about the same rates.
Violation of camaraderie.
Yeah, exactly. It is a violation of this just delightful social structure that forms.
If I'm not misremembering what I've done a little reading in the past about the odds on a craps table. And if I'm not misremembering, the don't pass options have a very slight advantage over the straight pass options, but it's not enough to make up for the fact that you're the bad guy.
It's like being the guy that bids one over somebody on The Price is Right.
Yeah.
Right? Where it's like, you know, somebody like Kevin will look at it and say, but it's the optimal move. It's the way to win. And then somebody like me will say, yeah, but it's not worth it. Like, it is your goal to win or is your goal to have fun playing the game? And, you know, this is actually a thing that I had written myself a note on my phone when I was listening to, I think I was listening to like Roderick on the Line, and they were talking about baseball. And I started thinking about baseball right after we had been playing a lot of The Resistance. Mm-hmm. And I remember remarking during the game when I found out that you are not, and you'll have to go back to the last two episodes ago or whatever when we talked about playing The Resistance. If you are not a spy, the game rules forbid you from sabotaging a mission. Hmm. And it stops you. Like, there's not any reason in that game why you would do that, I don't think. Because you're just actively losing points for your team when you do it. But, like, there are games where there is an advantage to not... to, like, doing some, like, just dick bullshit in the interim. And I was thinking about the infield fly rule, which I barely understand the infield fly rule, but I have understood it at points. And the way that I understand it is that it's basically, like, if you have guys on base and there is a pop fly hit that is very obviously going to get caught by an infielder... Mm-hmm. It's just automatically out, whether they catch it or not, because the optimal move for the infielder is to let it drop so that the ball is in play, and now you can suddenly, like, just get a triple play or a double play by just throwing it to all the bases that the dudes are supposed to be at. But, like, they see the infield, they see the pop fly, they think, oh, that's going to get caught, so they just hang tight because there's no sense in risking getting thrown out as they try to get back to their base. And so there is a rule that stops you from doing this, like, dick move that the vagaries of the rules make optimal in this given situation.
Well, okay. I don't know that
right?
it's...
And there was probably a time when you could trust people not to do it.
Because if the ball hits the ground, the person at home wants to run towards first base, but if the person who's on first base doesn't move, then they're just kind of screwed, right? Like... I guess that's a good question.
Well, no, I mean the thing is that so let's say the bases are loaded and there's a like a pop fly to the infield. You let it hit the ground, you pick it up, you throw it home, you throw it to third, you throw it to second. That's a triple play. right? Because there's, you can do that faster than those guys can make it to base, right? You get force outs. You get force outs at every base,
assuming that there's no errors,
by doing it.
Yeah.
And if you drop, well, sure, but I mean, right? But it, like, because missing that pop fly doesn't mean you have to chase it. It means you just have to pick it up because it's gonna land and just be where it landed, right? So it's not the same. Like, if there's a pop fly that the outfielder is probably going to catch, he might not catch it, but that still counts as a viable game state because A, it takes longer for the ball to get there, and B, he's further away. So, like, if he doesn't get it, right, it takes longer for him to grab it because it has more vertical velocity, horizontal velocity, and it'll take longer for him to throw it back to base. So it's not like this sort of like degenerate situation that you can get by fucking up on purpose.
So the optimal strategy is to hit it high enough that it does not land for several minutes.
And so you get the stratosphere rule double if the ball just doesn't come back down. And the guy at the crabs table, that's not what's happening because. And see, this is a thing that pisses me off when people, if I'm at a blackjack table with a bunch of people who get genuinely pissed off that there is a poor player in front of them, right? So the guy in front of you hits when he's not supposed to hit, and then that takes away the card that would have been good for you, and it takes away the card that would have been good for the next guy. But there is no fucking way to have known that.
Yeah,
every card is just as random as every other card.
All the cards in a deck of cards are in a quantum state. They all have the same value.
And you cannot talk somebody out of, if you're sitting at a blackjack table with the kind of person who is going to be pissed off at somebody who they think, in hindsight, is fucking up their shit. Mm-hmm. Like, and, you know, it took me a while. This is the same reason that, like, you actually have to perform an experiment in order for the scientific method to work. Because in order to prove that something is happening at a rate greater than chance, you have to give chance the opportunity to occur. You can't look at chance that occurred in the past and draw conclusions, because then that's just as good as being psychic. Right. I mean, and you can do things like, I remember getting into this argument with your girlfriend about data sets, Kevin.
Right.
Like, you can draw a conclusion based on half of a data set and not look at the other half and then say, I think the other half of this data set is going to support my conclusion. And right, that's kind of OK.
I mean, it's the, you know, sequestering, I think, of data is how they do astrophysics, right? Because, like,
you can probably get that. You can probably get that published. But it's it is an important part of thinking about probability that events in the future are categorically different than events in the past.
Right.
And with a craps table, it doesn't fucking matter how anybody bets, right? Like, no, each person is an island in the sense of this. There are no actual multiplayer elements of craps. Right, it kind of doesn't matter whether you're throwing the dice or somebody. I mean, it absolutely doesn't matter. When I say kinda, I mean totally. It doesn't matter who's throwing the dice, right?
Well, like, I mean, what if you have when you throw the dice, you make it always come up 6 and 1.
There was a guy, man. There was this crazy odd couple of dudes that came up to the table for a while, and it seemed like they both got to Vegas and they each went to the illicit substances vending machine, and one of them was like, I want all the joints, and the other one was like, I want all the meth. And then, all right, yeah, now we're gonna consume all these drugs that we just got from the vending machine, and then we're gonna go to the craps table. And the one guy, it was just like this crazy, like, jumping around, making up crazy bets, like throwing chips around, blah 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 blah. All right, every time it's his turn, just throw the dice. It's like, all right, I'm gonna flip around, throw them way up in the air, like, yeah. 11 on 2, 11 on 2, 2 on 11, 2 on 11, 2 on the yellow, 2 on the yellow, hard 11. Like, and his
hard
buddy
11?
And his buddy that, well, there is some 11, there is some specific one roll 11 bet that you can make, so it isn't anything on your side of the table, and it isn't any of the hard ways in the middle or the specific dice combinations. It's those little circles. There are these little circles that say C and E, and they have yellow borders. And so he kept saying 2 on yellow, 2 on yellow, 2 on yellow 11, 2 on yellow 11, and these are like, betting that the next throw will be an 11.
Okay.
Right, but it's not like having bets on the normal 11 bet in the middle where that bet stays there. And I think that might be because there is only one way to get an 11.
Yeah.
That, like, you can't, because if you bet on, like, the hard eight.
There's two, but they're the same one.
Right. Yeah. But you bet on the hard eight, which is two fours. There are a bunch of ways for eight to come up. And if any of those comes up, then your bet goes away. Mm-hmm. This one, this is just like a one-time thing. I'm not entirely sure what the deal is. I never really understood it. I asked him, and he was like, blah, 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 blah. Okay. Let me ask your buddy instead. And I asked his buddy, and his buddy was like, what? This guy, the stoner guy, kind of looked like Beardo John Lennon, and he just kept doing what the cracked out guy was telling him to do, and just kind of smiling. I don't know which one of them was having more fun, but it was great. Man, just high fives and fist bumps all around, and fuck that old guy, that old drunk guy that doesn't know what he's doing, keeps betting against us. He's not a member. He's the other. And then we had something to unite against. It was great.
Yeah. Put his head on a stick for the Lord of the Flies.
I mean, I guess that's the one thing that you don't get at a craps table that you do get at a sports bar if it's a split affiliation sports bar, right? Is that you don't have the other. Mm-hmm. You don't have anybody to give a raspberry to. I'm assuming this is a bar where they serve raspberries. Yeah, so that was my Thanksgiving.
It sounds awesome.
Video games?
Video games?
Have you been playing any video games?
Let's see.
We need a theme song to introduce this video game segment.
We do.
Beedly boop 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 beedly boop boop
video games. I played, well, let's see. Played some World of Warcraft, played a little bit of Minecraft. I'm chugging along through A Fool and His Money. I think I've got like six puzzles left to unlock all of the map pieces.
Is it maintaining your interest?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
Would you recommend buying it?
Yes. If you're into a mystery hunt puzzle quest.
I mean, what is it? Is it still like $30 or something?
It's like 40? I think it's like $30 or $40.
Yeah.
It's okay though. Like it, I know that I feel like I said on a previous episode that I didn't feel like it was worth $40, but thinking about it now, like, what other deep puzzle games can I buy?
Yeah.
Like, none. Yeah, so I exactly. will pay whatever this one costs, right? And this is, it's like artisanal.
Not all of the puzzles are fun. I mean, there's some of them that you hit one of these and it's like, this one again, all right, and you chore your way through it. But I feel like which type of puzzle that is probably going to be different for most people.
The problem that I had with The Fool's Errand, the reason that I would be hesitant to buy something else by that guy is that the overall meta puzzle seemed a little unfair to me, like figuring out how to put the map together in the first place. Yeah, the map seemed like, having looked at a spoiler about how to get the map put together in the first place, I was like, yeah, I was not going to get there.
The map seems a lot more straightforward this time.
And then there
I've already located which puzzles give you the bits of meta puzzle information you need to know to how to rearrange the map, and it's pretty straightforward.
And the ones that relied on particular, like the bullshit like mouse puzzles where you just had to like, here's a million flickering numbers.
There
just
have
click
not
on them in
been
sequence.
Any dexterity puzzles in this.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah. There's been.
You're having fun with it though?
Yeah, it's pretty cool. There's a set of seven puzzles that are not related to the map. They don't give you map pieces for solving them, and that has turned out to be, I guess, some kind of multi-layered meta puzzle in itself. And I've solved the first layer of that, but have been waiting until I've finished the map before going any deeper with that. But yeah, it's been pretty entertaining. I'm getting a lot of use out of morewords.com and whatever Scrabble dictionary I'm using online, but
are there a lot of anagramming puzzles? I hear anagramming puzzles are the new hotness.
There are a lot of word jumbles. There's a recurring puzzle type that is like a sort of like a crossword, except you've got like four words and they're crossed, so you've got like a square of these words, and all the letters in them in each line or column are scrambled, and so you have to unscramble them to make the four words, and they're seven or eight letter words. So it's kind of rough, or was rough to me, unless I had a Scrabble dictionary available. And then there's like a dozen of those in that puzzle. So it's like, unscramble these 38 letter words.
Wow. 38 letter words.
Yeah.
I mean, how many 38 letter words are there? There must be, if not, I think it would be, I don't even know why I'm saying this out loud, because it would be fairly easy to write a program that would generate one of these. But I think a thing that might be of some use to us in future endeavors is a database of all of the pairings of words that are single, like sets of seven letters that only have one anagram, or words that, well, that would be two different things of value. Words that only anagram to one other word, and also sets of letters that only anagram to one word.
I wonder if, because I know More Words has that data. I wonder if they have some kind of like API or database that they'll let you download.
I don't know. They're not a for-profit outfit. I was trying real hard to get us some sort of like access to Merriam-Webster.com's API. Yeah, I told the guy what I wanted, and he asked me a few questions, and I sent him some clarification, and then just never heard anything from them at all.
Huh.
Mm. Emails, man.
I mean,
people
maybe
just ignore them.
It's actually just some sort of like money laundering operation for the mob, and they don't actually want people who are legitimate.
Oh, I thought you were going to say maybe their customer service is just some sort of like a Turing machine experiment, and I was actually speaking to the dictionary.
That's an even cooler idea, actually.
So the other thing of note that I played was the new Adventure Time game for 3DS. Adventure Time, Hey Ice King, Why Did You Steal Our Garbage?
Okay. You mean, Hey Ice King, Why Did You Steal Our Fart?
It is good in some ways, not so good in other ways. The art is really fantastic. All the backgrounds are hand-drawn, and it's pixel art sprites, and Paul Robertson did some of the pixel animation, so the animation is all really good. He's the guy that did the pixel animation for the Scott Pilgrim video game. And
is he any relation to Robert Paulson?
No, he's the guy who did, if you've ever seen the internet video, Pirate Baby Cabana Battle Street Fight 2006.
I have not.
I'll have to link that to you because it's pretty awesome.
You'll have to what?
Link. Oh. Link it to you.
Okay.
What did you think?
I thought you said like that to me.
I'll have to like that to you. And I'm going to click the thing to give it a
Facebook
thumbs up.
Bullshit.
Then, yeah.
Because nope.
So yeah, all the art is really good. The music is really good. The writing ranges from good to hilarious. So all the content is really well. The non gameplay content is really great. The mechanical and gameplay aspects are kind of ho hum. It's basically Zelda 2 Adventure of Link, except greatly condensed and greatly simplified and made much easier.
I mean, is Adventure Time for children?
Pendleton Ward has stated that he writes it for himself and his friends.
I mean, does he say that because he heard the Looney Tunes guys say that in an interview once?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I wonder, is this what Looney Tunes was like to contemporary, like, 30-something
viewers?
Stoners.
Huh.
Right? Like, did they were like, oh, yeah, man, we get it. We get it. You guys have also been smoking the jazz cigarettes. Not to characterize, there is not one of us that is a stoner. But, you know, I'm just saying, that seems to be like, if I were to guess who the target audience for Adventure Time was, it would be a split decision between children and stoners. Hmm. I mean, sort of like Bullwinkle. Contemporary Bullwinkle show watchers, I think, were mostly just stoned hippies in dorm rooms.
Possible.
I mean, I watched it a lot as a kid, and I was totally stoned, so.
You were like a stoned baby.
Right.
There were some very specific Dungeons and Dragons call-outs in a season 4 episode I saw recently that I don't think any average kid, like a lot of
cartoons. But I mean, you know, South Park is not targeted at kids. Yeah. I think the adult, like most of Adult Swim, is not targeted at kids, right? But
hence
is
the,
Adventure
the
Time
word
on
adult.
Well, sure. Okay. Good. Yeah. Good. Good point. I didn't. Okay. Touche, Kevin. So, I mean, but what I'm saying is this a kid's game?
It may well be a kid's game.
So, I mean, you got to give it a little bit of leeway for being
easy,
and overly simplistic.
Yeah, I
right?
mean, I would not. I mean, I still enjoyed it. I thought it was a very charming game, very joyful. It just was not challenging at all.
Is it weird to take an intellectual property that was geared for one sort of demographic and have a game in sort of a different demographic? Like, if Adventure Time isn't really for kids and they make a kids game, then like, would it be equally weird to take like a Smurfs game and make it like sort of gritty adult themed and just like totally inappropriate for children? Like
American McGee's the Smurfs.
American McGee's Smurfs.
Yeah. Right. Like, it seems like that's a bad plan, both in terms of marketing and just like knowing your audience and that kind of thing. Like,
I mean, I did hear that there's going to be a Binding of Isaac cartoon on Nickelodeon next season.
Wow. It's
Isaac and the Basement Buddies.
Oh, that would be so good.
Now I kind of want that to exist.
Yeah. I want to visit the universe where that happens.
Hey, Riff, can I borrow your Adventure Time 3DS game?
Yeah, I'm done with it.
I think that I'm done playing Sticker Star.
Really?
Yeah, I played a bunch more, like, not necessarily a bunch. I played through 2 of the 5 sets of levels, and I just kind of don't, I don't care to continue. Like, it's got a lot of annoying adventure game aspects in the just, like, there's an object that you found somewhere else. Finding that guy that will sell you all of the real, like, the 3D objects to let you make a new set. Like, oh, okay, finally, something that I can spend my coins on. Mm-hmm. But then it's just like, nope, I can spend my coins on, like, this bullshit, expensive trial and error for solving these puzzles. Like, I said, what was the trick to beating the first boss?
You know, I don't know. And actually, now that you mentioned that, that directly pissed me off because of the way, like, I get if you beat that boss not using whatever the trick is, your companion makes fun of you.
Wow, you sure did use a lot of stickers beating that boss. Are you stupid or something?
Yeah.
Stupid? Like,
I was like, damn, fuck you, man.
Yeah, okay. Like, you don't think at this point in the game you could have just fucking told me what the trick was so that I would know what kind of thing is the trick in the future? Like, knowing that there was a trick made it so I was paying attention to the second boss, and it very much clues in.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, wow, this boss sure does look like he's sitting on a baseball field, and they sure are making a lot of baseball jokes. I guess it must be the ping pong paddle that I use to defeat this guy. But
although, like, I mean, even once you know that it's the bat, you still have to experiment with it a little bit to figure out the best way to use it.
Pretty obnoxious. That was the point at which I just cut the power and reloaded from a previous save. I was like, fuck you, game. I'm not going to let this play out. Like, I see what you just did to me, and fuck you. and then it got to this, like, all right, well, there's another puzzle you have to solve to get into the third level. Like, you know, you just got to put a thing in front of this guy to wake him up.
Yeah.
And I was just like, yeah, I don't care to do this. And, right, you know, I'd been carrying around this stupid bugle, and it turns out it's the bugle. But I didn't want to try it because I don't know where the fuck that bugle came from. I don't know how I'm going to get another one.
Yeah.
I might need that bugle for something in the future that's obvious.
Like,
and also,
snacking.
The bugle is a tiny sticker. The space they give you to put the sticker in to wake up this stupid fucking caterpillar is huge.
Yeah.
Like all the other huge goddamn things. I'm like, well,
fooled me
can't
for a
be
long
the bugle.
Time. Yeah.
And then I just like, I looked at a walkthrough, saw that it was the bugle, and just was like, yep, whatever. And I put the game away. I played a bunch of it while I was in Vegas because all I had was my 3DS. Oh, and Chip Chain. Man. Chip Chain.
I agree with all your objections to it, but they have not spoiled the game for me as much as they seem to have for you.
I mean, I don't know that they spoiled it.
I interrupted playing it to play Adventure Time, and I'll probably go back to it.
I've just got a bunch of other shit I could play, you know, yeah. And there's nothing about... I still maintain my fundamental objection to the mechanics of Sticker Star is that it... RPG tropes do not work if you subvert the fundamental rules that make an RPG a game that you can play, right?
What do you mean by subvert the fundamental rules?
You subvert the fundamental rules by having... there is nothing that you can do except use combat items, right? Okay. And fighting monsters only ever makes you weaker.
Yeah.
Right, and that's so the fundamental thing about an RPG in my mind is you kill something and it makes you stronger.
Yeah.
Or it either kills you or it makes you stronger. And in this, all it can do is make you weaker.
You say that, like, and there are definitely cases that I like. They're not like mainstream, but like monsters that drain experience or levels in games. And actually end up leaving you weaker than before you fought them if you do not kill them handily, right?
But they are placed as either punitive measures or plot points, right?
The experience you get for killing them is balancing to the risk.
You are better off in Paper Mario Sticker Star if you never fight any monsters that aren't required to advance the story, and that's just fucked up. Like, the monsters just become a, like, thing where every time a fight starts, you're not like, oh boy, this is going to be fun. What's going to happen? It's like, God damn it. I was unable to avoid getting into this fight, so now I have to waste some resources getting nothing out of this fight. Like,
so you,
and
get,
it, I mean,
you literally
it becomes,
get nothing from the fights? There's no additional consumables?
You get a handful of coins.
Yeah.
Which you can, you know, you can go back to town, I guess, and buy some more stickers. It again, they are the people who say that you never run out of stickers are correct because they're just everywhere. And you're in, you know, if you fight everything, if you don't fight stuff, your inventory is just full all the time.
You are, yeah.
If you fight everything,
you're stuck in a mindset like it's just challenging the mindset of your like preconceived notions about how these games work. And sometimes I think you welcome those kinds of like paradigm shifts, and this one you're like really rejecting it handily, and it's interesting to see that because like they're like giving you the option to explore a world and collect resources, and then you know really use those resources. There's like nothing. It sounds like there's like no equipment or whatever. There's like if everything is consumable,
right.
that's kind of interesting.
There's not, and so but in a game that works like that, the core loop needs to be like if you were to think of the primary like gameplay loop of this game as exploring spaces and gathering things that you then had to use to overcome puzzles, right? If you treat it more like an adventure game, then you need to just not have the fucking wandering monsters in it, because the wandering monsters, as opposed to becoming like a resource to manage like they are in other Paper Mario games, right? And it, to some extent, like every role-playing game, fights are a resource that you have that you use to level up your dudes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some of them give you more control over how many of the fights that you get into, and some of them give you less, right? Paper Mario games have always been about, like, you can see the monsters on the map, so you can avoid them if you want to, but you kind of want to fight them because you get stuff for beating them.
Because
you are rewarded with experience points, with items, with coins for overcoming these obstacles. But in Sticker Star, you never get more than it costs to win the fight out of the fight. unless it is a plot critical fight, which those are the ones I don't mind. I don't mind fighting a boss. It's like, all right, so here's a boss. I'm going to use some resources to defeat this boss because what I get for winning this fight is I get progress through the story. I get a new area to explore. I get,
so
you know,
because
I get a
you
new
recognize
power.
The wandering monsters as random, that takes the satisfaction away. If they were, if you were more naive and you were like, oh, there's a monster there, I guess I better beat it because I have to, because that's how I'm supposed to get, you know, I need to get from point A to point B and this monster is between me, and you think of it as like a mandatory challenge, I think you would also not be as concerned about it, right? Like, you are ascribing a lot of, you're bringing with you a lot of like notions about how games work and how they're supposed to work, and it's making you really dissatisfied. But if you could let that go,
sure.
I don't think it would bother
as much. I don't think that this particular one is an unfair notion, right? Like, so when you are playing, like, Metroid, and you are running through spaces, you have the option to either avoid monsters or fight them. But if you fight them, you are taking a risk. Mm-hmm. For the potential reward of getting a missile or a health power up or whatever.
Right.
And you will hedge your bets. You will, like, well, I can sit here and I can fight a bunch of these easy monsters to maybe get, you know, after 10 minutes of doing this, to get my energy filled up. Or right. I can go and I can try to take on some harder monsters, which will drop a bigger energy ball or, you know, are more likely to give me a missile
or could
whatever.
You could be bad at the game and you could be hit by a bunch of monsters without killing them and lose
right.
a bunch of resources.
Sure. Right. And I mean, I guess that's the thing. This takes combat, which is generally the central loop of an RPG, right? Mm-hmm. The main thing that you are doing is fighting enemies in an RPG. And it makes it a thing that is only ever punitive. And that is what I reject. Right? It is... And I mean, there's not, you know, there's no way around it if you've decided that the way the systems in this game work is that you have no abilities that aren't consumable, right? Because if everything gives you more stickers than it takes to kill it, then you only ever lose stickers by selling them or whatever.
Right.
And that's, like, I mean, I think that the fundamental dissatisfaction that I experience in this is enough to convince me that, like, that branch is a dead end.
Yeah.
Like an RPG where all of your abilities are consumable is a dead end.
I think it's not just that. I feel like if instead of getting more health points, more hearts by occasionally finding a +5 hearts container, if instead of that you got experience points for killing a guy, and every so many experience points, you got another heart point.
Yep.
Then that would make it 100% better.
Yeah. No, me too.
So, but I mean, if it had that, it would be okay if it was that and the entirely consumable fights, is what I mean.
And I mean, I guess that's the thing, right? Like, so the game that this is very similar to Metroid, right? Like, you get items that make you more powerful that are out in the world, and you have to fight your way past monsters to get to them. But for some reason, having the combats switch to this turn-based mode where you're having to spend resources to beat them, you know, instead of, like, your resource in Metroid, which is, like, time and skill,
yeah,
you know, grating.
You also have resources in Metroid. Like, it is... It's a little more abstract, right? It's instead of having like an inventory of attacks or whatever, you have as many attacks as you want to do, but you have a finite amount of health that does not automatically recharge, and you can sometimes get some health from enemies. And like they set it up, they balanced it in such a way that there are plenty of places where you can just stand there and kill stuff relatively easily and like farm up health. But you could also not notice that and feel like fights were just bullshit because you kept losing more and more health and there was no good way to replenish it because you're not good at
it. Well,
okay,
but in Metroid, skillful play results in fights being a net positive for your character.
Yeah.
Right?
Sure.
In
you don't have
Star,
to worry about running out of bullets.
There is no way for fights to be a net positive. There is never... From a rational standpoint, there is never any reason to do anything except avoid fights like the plague.
Okay.
And in a game where most of the systems are centered around the fights, that's just kind of like a self-defeating bullshit scheme.
So, I mean, not having played the game, it's hard for me to like talk about it in a systems sense. But are there stickers that are obviously more common than other stickers? And like,
yes,
the idea of using them is not that repellent. Like, I feel like if I knew that like it was really easy for me to go farm sticker A, B, and C, I would be like, eh, whatever. I'll just use these stickers whenever I encounter a monster that I know is a random encounter. Because if I really ever need them, I can go get them again. And I'll always just save all of my rare or special stickers.
Right, except the only reason that you ever encounter one of those enemies is because you fucked up.
Okay, but I mean, so that's so the game becomes how do I dodge enemies that I don't want
it feels
to
like
fight?
Right. So what the game becomes a thing where its primary system becomes a mechanism for punishing failures rather than rewarding successes.
Well, but
and
there,
it's just
there,
it's a fr-
there are
it's a framing
definitely
thing,
some
right?
There are some fights that you have to do to progress the game, right? Like,
yeah, and that is one out of about every 100 fights that are available to you is one that is actually required to progress the game, and those fights are they're more mechanically interesting, and they are. You don't feel bad about using resources to win them because you are getting something for them, which is plot advancement. I mean, I don't know.
How do you feel about a regular non-boss monster that is placed in the world in such a way that it's not possible to progress without killing it?
That feels okay.
Okay.
Because I don't, like, I feel like by defeating that monster, I am getting something. And that is access. No, I don't mind paying a toll. What I mind is, like, If in The Legend
mugged.
Of Zelda, yeah, being mugged. Hmm. That's it, right? And The thing is, you can run away from every fight, and there is fucking no reason not to. Every time you get into a fucking fight, hit the run button, tap on A enough times to like make it more likely that you're going to be able to run away from it. It's just like, why the fuck are those things even there? Like, it is not a good idea to fight them. It is trivial. But a pain in the, like, you got to tap on a thing on the touch screen to run away from them.
Do you
like
acquire
the menu
coins
element
from
to run
things
away from
other
fights.
Than fights?
You acquire stickers from things other than fights.
No, I know, but like, so I guess my question is like, you acquire coins from fights, right?
Yeah,
or currency from fights, some kind of
yeah.
currency.
Uh-huh. You acquire orders of magnitude more coins from finding secret places in the world and finishing levels.
Okay. And you can also sell stickers, which are an infinitely renewable resource.
Yeah, you can go into a level that has a shiny. The stickers might be shiny at random. Like a level
some
might
of them
have
are
like,
and some of them
a aren't. Level might have 10 yeah. stickers and like one of the 10 will be shiny and that's worth 10 times as many coins.
I've seen there's some places that where it'll be a shiny sticker the first time you get it, and after that, it's not when you go back. And there's levels where I've seen there's a sticker here. There's always a shiny stomp sticker at this location. Right. And then there's some places I've seen where there is a type of attack sticker here, and it may or may not be shiny anytime you go to it.
Do the shiny stickers do more damage? Are they worth more in combat? As
yeah,
well?
Yes. They are. They're more valuable as attacks, and they sell for 10 times as much.
And they're prettier.
They are pretty. Sure. They're like that kind of glisteny sticker, and they, when you tilt the DS, they glisten like they're reflecting light. I know.
I mean,
this is basically
that it
is
dissatisfying.
Like,
I'm just trying to figure out like why, how would the system have evolved as far as it did, like, you know, as an actual released product, if this was something that was like a universal feeling, like the clearly somebody felt like this was a good idea and was excited by this system enough to like actually,
well,
you know, through the whole process of developing this thing. And I'm wondering
it's possible
like, what the problems are.
It's possible that it doesn't bother other people as much as it bothers people who've spent a lot of time thinking about the design of turn-based resource management systems. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it doesn't, like, I think you could have described this game to me, and I would have said it would be pretty difficult to do this in a way that I don't think is bullshit, right? And I will give it the benefit of the doubt because it is in a series that I love, and you know it's put out by a company that I trust. But then I get a hold of it, and it's kind of bullshit. And
I mean, I have a really hard time.
I don't think most people would feel. Most people, if you describe this game to them, they would think, "Oh, stickers." Ah.
Yeah, I mean, I have a really hard time with games, you know, like Farmville or whatever, where you're given a number of options. The idea of doing anything but the most efficient option, unless there is some obvious secondary like goal or reward for it, just like is really repellent to me. And so it seems like that kind of thinking would be pretty poisonous for this, you know, the sticker, whatever it is, sticker sword, sticker.
Crap. Yeah, but I mean, it's clearly not like that's clearly not a universal thing, right? Like things right. that like you will look at decisions that are made in a Farmville, like, all right, so here are these options that are being presented to me. There is literally no gameplay reason for these first two options to exist, but mm-hmm. I am sure that their A/B testing resulted in them finding out that people felt more satisfied if they were able to discover that this option was a better deal than these right. other options. And go for it, right? I mean, there's the it's like that the Mark Wahlberg article from Magic: The Gathering. Mark Rosewater, not Mark Wahlberg. Where there are bad, quote unquote, bad cards in every Magic set for deliberate reasons. Those reasons being suboptimal players like big numbers, and they will have fun playing with a Magic card that has big numbers on it, but is not something that any like pro circuit Magic player would ever be caught dead with in his deck, maybe in his sideboard for irony.
So like it costs too much, but has it like has a high power and toughness or something?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, I mean, because you like so, I am stupid. When I first discovered Magic, I was like, well, why the fuck wouldn't you just make a deck that was all Crawworms? It's more powerful than all of the other monsters. So right. what the fuck, bro? And then it was explained to me by my, you know, by my mathematician friend who was introducing me to Magic. Well, you can't cast it as early, right? And so if all you have is these and somebody else has like a wide variety of things, they're going to get creatures out and just kill you before you get a chance to summon one of these. And I thought, oh, so it's a numbers game, eh?
Oh, so no, there are the kids that I would also have a bunch of Black Lotuses in my deck, and therefore it wouldn't be a problem.
Right, right, right. So what I want is one Lord of the Pit, 90 Dark Rituals, and 10 Swamps. Like that is the yeah. unstoppable deck. So there is the kid that enjoys playing with big ass monsters, right? That are like. I'm not necessarily gonna get this out unless I'm playing against other like naive players like me who also enjoy this kind of thing, and then we're both gonna have a good time with some big old monsters. Like, man, I'm attacking you for 14, and that's a lot. And then there are the like mid-range kids who feel better about themselves because they are able to look at the mm-hmm. Crawworm and another monster and see why the other monster is better, even though it is not obviously from looking at the numbers better.
Right.
Right? And then there is the high level player who is like, why the fuck is Crawworm even in the set? No one would ever use that. Right? And maybe that's what's going on here, right?
You're a high level like, player and you're like, why the fuck are these combats even in the game?
Exactly. I mean maybe they looked at that. Maybe the designers were like, eh. Whatever, you know, it's like they're like this isn't gonna go down in the annals of RPG history as like a super well designed thing, but like we're gonna give this a shot. We're gonna make an RPG where all of the attacks are consumables. You know, it's like because hey, you know how in RPGs nobody ever wants to use their combat items and they just hoard them because they might need them someday. Yeah. Let's fuck with that predisposition. Well, let's turn the tables on that and see what happens. And then they made this thing and they were like, huh, yeah. Well, it turns out this kind of fucking sucks. Oh, well. You know, it's cute. It's in a popular franchise. A bunch of people will play it, and most of them will enjoy it. And, like, whatever. We don't care if some asshole talks shit about our game on some video games podcast. That guy only bought two copies of this game. So there. I'm not even, like, I'm, like, doing the opposite of putting my money where my mouth is.
Yeah. I honestly really am interested / excited in this game because of the idea that it is forcing you to use consumables because that's all there is. Like that is interesting to me, and I'm, you know, it's sad. It is sad to me that it is turning out to be so dissatisfying.
It does force you to use consumables, but it ends up being a lot more, it ends up being even sadder than the usual I never use my consumable situation, because you end up like getting into a fight with a one hit point Goomba and not having any cheapo stickers to kill it with, and having to use like a 15 damage shiny rainbow sticker on this goddamn Goomba. It hurts your soul, man.
But you know what? You know why it doesn't hurt your soul? Is because you remember, oh, wait, I can just run away from this fight without fucking penalty.
Well, yeah. Once you've, like, started doing that.
Yeah, exactly. It's, like, it's just, yeah.
Yep.
Ah, man, someday, I don't dislike the Mario and Luigi RPGs, but they're not like Paper Mario was like this perfect spiritual successor to Super Mario RPG. Mm-hmm. And then Paper Mario the Thousand Year Door was a just sort of like HD remake of Paper Mario, and I was really hoping that this was going to be like the next game in that series, but in fact it is just this divergence down what I think is kind of a dead end alley. And that makes me kind of sad.
Did you not like the Mario and Luigi ones as much?
I did. They're fine, but they're just different.
So this game makes me want to go back and play Bowser's Inside Story.
I never finished Bowser's Inside Story.
It was good. Yeah.
I was enjoying it. What was the one where there was one of the Mario and Luigi games, I got all the way to the end boss and then just couldn't beat the end boss. Like, I just was like, I kept doing the fight and couldn't get the timing right to avoid the attacks. Mm. And so I was just like, after I did it 10 times, I was like, I've played this. Like, I don't fucking care what the ending cutscene is. And, like, this isn't going to give me the ability to do anything else if I beat this one. I think the same thing happened to me with Minish Cap. Like, really? I played all the way through the Minish Cap, didn't beat the boss. And it was just like, whatever. I've played it. What have you been playing, Kevin? I have a few more, but I'll let somebody else talk for a while.
I've been playing a couple of iOS games. I spent a bunch of time playing Free Flow. I don't remember if I talked about that on the last podcast or not. It's
I have actually one more thing to say real quick.
Yeah.
I beat the first level of Super Hexagon.
Huh.
Woo! 63 seconds.
First level?
the first difficulty, which is hard, I have now advanced to harder.
Oh, Jesus. That sucks. I'm sorry.
What's your highest time in harder so far?
I think, like, my first time playing it, I think I made 34 seconds, and I have not gotten better than, like, 10 or 15 since then.
Wow.
So it was kind of a fluke. But anyway, sorry, you were saying?
Free Flow is it's like a puzzle game where you are connecting two dots with lines in a constrained space, and the lines have they take up space, and so it's sort of like a how can I fill this space up with lines without them crossing over each other, and still fill every available space in a square. And it starts out very simple with like 5x5 puzzles, and then gets up to like 14x14. By the end, which makes it a
little more challenging. Have you been playing it on the iPad?
No. They say iPad, but they totally work on an iPhone.
Oh, I just assumed it wouldn't run on the iPad. Wow, that makes it more interesting if I can actually play those higher density puzzles.
Yeah, those are the ones that are more challenging.
It is a surprisingly like meditative and relaxing game to play.
It is not fundamentally tricky. I mean, some of the higher levels or the higher order levels are definitely more sort of mentally challenging, but it's not hard. It is just a matter of like like.
Yeah, just it takes some. It takes patience. I mean, it takes patience and some trial and error. And, you know, I mean, you can look at it. It's the speed trial mode is interesting.
Yeah.
Right, because it's like you have 1 minute, or I kind of wish that it wasn't like a I wish it wasn't a user specified amount of time. Like you can play it either 30 seconds or a minute or 2 minutes.
What's this called?
Flow.
Just flow.
Yeah.
And or it might actually like solve. It's called Free Flow, I think. Actually,
Free Flow or Flow Free. Solve as many of these puzzles as you can in 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. And I recognize.
And it's like it's. I really enjoy like. Okay, all right, here we go. And hitting the thing, and just like how many of these like simple puzzles can I solve?
Right.
Because it's like a sort of like a finger dexterity challenge and a like hoping you don't get stuck on some stupid challenge.
Yeah. I like
I have actually been spending a surprising amount of time playing this game too.
On my like 30-second trial, when I got to a certain threshold and I hadn't gotten twice that many on the 1 minute one, I was like, oh well, clearly I need to work on the 1 minute one because I could do better. And so I kept working on the higher level, the higher time ones to get it so that it was a proper multiple of my 30-second score. Which I don't know if that's a worthwhile endeavor. But yeah, so that's an interesting sort of puzzle game, and it was, you know, as the name implies, it was free. You can buy more levels for it if you want, but it's not required. I was introduced to a letter, so like a word game, on my trip to Boston, which I've been playing
a few games
with you, Zach. Called letter
yeah, press. I was also introduced to this word game, and it's pretty much just get violated by Kevin. describe the rules of this game while I go get a beer to drown my failure sorrows.
Okay, so it is a 5x5 grid of letters. I am pretty sure that the letters are completely random because there will often be like Q's without associated U's and a bunch of like a very small set of vowels sometimes, that kind of thing. You can make a word using any of the 25 letters. If you do, those letters become colored with your color. If you surround a letter tile on all four sides or three sides if it's on a side, or you know, the two sort of adjoining ones if it's in a corner piece, it becomes a darker version of your color, which means that if somebody else uses that letter in a word, or if your opponent uses that letter in a word, it does not switch immediately to their color on the next turn. So like there's a way to sort of build up territory, but your borders are always available to your opponent, basically. And so it becomes this sort of complicated game where you can't sort of duplicate words that have already been played or subsets of those words that have already been played. Like if I play hinged, you cannot play hinge or whatever, right? But you could play hinges because that's a different word. And so it's both sort of a vocabulary game, like having a good vocabulary and being able to like make words out of sort of pretty high levels of possible letter sets, but also sort of an interesting strategy thing because, you know, a Q that doesn't have a U associated with it, if I don't know more than one or two words that you have an isolated Q, and so capturing that Q early on means it's basically going to be yours for the rest of the game. And so it's that plus like, you know, figuring out that if there's only a couple of vowels, if you can get those sort of surrounded early on, that they're going to be, the opponent's going to be forced to use those to make words and not able to capture as much territory. Getting letters along the sides is better because you're able to hold on to those easier because they have fewer borders with other tiles and stuff.
Game where the possibility space of a move like rapidly gets out of hand in my head. I think like we have played a bunch of games and in every single case, like it is a zero sum game where there are 25 points to be had and you have beaten me 23-2 or 24-1 or 22-3 in every game that we have played. I've had fairly reasonable luck playing with strangers, like just starting random games with other people. And I don't like this game reveals something about the way that you and I approach games.
Really?
I think. Because I don't understand what you are doing that is making it so you are kicking my ass so hard. Like it is fascinating to me, but I'm really put off by it, just like in the way that you're put off by something that you just like, oh, I'm gonna see if I'm any good at this, and then you just like fall off of a cliff and die the first time you try it. Right? Like, well, I guess hot air ballooning is not for me. I forgot to bring a balloon.
I've only played, you know, I played mostly with you and like two or three games with strangers. So I don't know if there's something. I have not had a much chance to like build up a repertoire of play with other people.
It does seem like a game where a lead is unassailable. Like a lead at a certain point becomes unassailable, and a game can go on for a very, very long time. Like you can definitely do. Like we ended up in a game that lasted a really long time because the only two unclaimed tiles were a Q and a Z, and because there was no U, there was no way to claim those tiles in one move. So it was just like this sort of somebody had to claim one of them with absolute confidence that the opponent could not win the game on the next turn by claiming the other one and forcing the game to end. And so it took a really long time for you to get an unassailable enough advantage that you felt comfortable doing that.
Right. I think it is fascinating how much strategy and gameplay there is, given how relatively simple this rule set is.
Yeah, it is if you had described this game to me, I would have probably guessed that it wouldn't work. Because there is the randomness with which the tiles are selected, I think could maybe use a little bit of work.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, I definitely would massage that randomness if I were designing the game.
There have been a lot of games where there have been like two or three Z's on a 5x5 grid
or four Y's. It is extremely random, and you know, and maybe the designer was like, you know, it is going to make for some weird games, but that's okay. You know, some people.
You know what? You know what I think would be. What I think would be really, really fascinating is this game, except on a 25x25 grid.
With many, many
games. It could have, right? But I was just going to say two, right? And your goal, the win state, is having a certain number of defended tiles.
Oh, yeah. I could see that, too. Because you'd probably start in a corner or a side and try to build up territory, and like your opponent would be like picking away at your front lines while also trying to build up their territory.
What the problem with that gets to be that you can on a 25x25 grid of letters,
make almost any word,
it just becomes a word. It just becomes a who can come up with the longest word.
Have to be more like Boggle. You would have to have some kind of thing where you couldn't pick a letter from anywhere.
Well, I mean, in this, like, what I imagine happening on this is that, I mean, like, maybe, you know, maybe it just limits you to 8-letter words or 10-letter words or something. But you would, and I mean, this is kind of what happens in this game, is that you are spending part of your resources picking letters that are on their fronts so that you can chip away at their defended tiles, and then part of them fortifying your own position. It seems like, I mean, I should not speak strategically about this game, because clearly my strategic ability in this game is that of a dead baby. But it seems like what you are trying to do is balancing. I mean, the way that I've been trying to play against strangers is more or less they play a word, and then I try to play the longest possible word that contains the most of their tiles as possible. Just preventing them from claiming territory. I don't think that that's what Kevin does when he plays against me.
Well, I'm doing that and also trying to claim unclaimed tiles. And if at all possible, which is, you know, sort of like a tertiary concern, is like also build up a stronger and stronger section of my own territory that has tiles that you can't take. I mean, there's a bunch of different things that you can do. Like it depends on the board, right? Like if there's a cluster of vowels and there aren't very many vowels on the board, if you can get those and you can defend those, the opponent is going to be stuck to some extent using those and not ever being able to claim them because they can't get enough other letters going at the same time, right? Like, I don't know. I mean, like, I think I probably don't even know a lot of the subtleties to it yet because I've only played, 8 or 10 games.
So this game is called Letterpress, and everyone should play it.
Yeah, it's free. Like, I like their model. It's like they let you start 2 games for free, and then if you want to play more and more games, you just have to give them some money. And I was like, huh, you know, I think if I keep playing this for more than just a couple days, that I would totally do that, because it is pretty satisfying to have 4 or 5 games going at the same time, because people can take anywhere from 30 seconds to multiple days to make their move. So
I ended up giving Chip Chain some money. I don't remember if that was a game that you bought to begin with, or if it was a game that was free, but either way, it was, you know, saddled with the modern microtransaction bullshit. But
I poked at that game for a little bit, but it didn't catch
me. Really?
Yeah.
Man, I love it. I've been playing it. Like, yesterday I gave them some money and unlocked all the game modes, and yesterday and today I've been spending a bunch of time playing the daily puzzle, which is just, like, it gives everybody the same set of chips to play a game with, and then there's a leaderboard at the end. And so I just, like, you know, over the course of today, went from 2,000th place on the leaderboard to 200th place on the leaderboard. And I was like, nice. I'm feeling pretty good about myself and my ability to play this game. Although what does kind of suck is that a lot of the way that you get high scores on that is by spending a bunch of the microtransaction gems on additional, like, action cards to manipulate the board with. I could have given them $10 to get unlimited gems. But I gave them $5 to get more gems than you really need for anything. Instead, it's a good game, though. I keep going back to it, and it's like, it is a thing that doesn't require, like, I can't play Letterpress, I can't play Word Feud while I'm listening to podcasts. But things that are, like, it is, because it is numbers, it is abstract enough that I can play it without listening to dudes talking, fucking it up. Or I guess ladies talking, if there were ladies that did podcasts. We're working on it. There's going to be another episode of Video Games Taco. Maybe before this. I don't actually know.
Hopefully one after this, although not necessarily immediately.
Yeah, it seems like they're shooting for a regular schedule. And if they do a few, they're probably going to set up a separate feed for it. Yeah, they're going to branch off. That'll be cool, and I'll have to teach. I'll teach one of them to edit it, so then it just won't be my problem anymore.
There you go.
I got enough podcasts to edit. Hey, speaking of podcasts, the guy, Cole that we met.
Yeah.
You didn't riff because you're not cool enough.
I don't meet anybody
that does Watch Out for Fireballs. Started a new. This is the beginning of the news segment. He sort of relaunched a podcast that he had been doing that was a follow-up from a college radio show that they did. And then the new version of it is called The Level. And it's pretty good. There have only been 2 episodes.
What's it about?
Video games.
Ah, cool.
It's about video.
How is it different than...
It is a bunch of white guys talking about video games. Well, you'll feel right at home.
Different from Watch Out for Fireballs?
Well, Watch Out for Fireballs is like Game Club, right? Where it's about a game. Okay. And this is just them talking about the games that they've played. So it's a lot of like, this is what I've been playing on the phone while pooping. This is what I've been playing on the PS3 while pooping.
Cool. I'll have to check that out.
Another game that I played over the weekend before the news was Bomberman Generations, which was pretty fucking great, actually. I think it was a GameCube game. And we played it four players. It was me and Melissa. I think she talked about it on her episode of Video Games Taco, too. But it was four players. And you, everybody starts in the corner, and you're doing like the regular Bomberman thing, and you're trying to like blow stuff up to reveal power-ups, but the bombs can also potentially kill you. And the goal is to place bombs that don't kill you, but eventually kill your opponents. And it is strategic and fun and arcadey. It's like, even if you lose, you're still involved in the game. You like become like a sort of like an annoying force on the outside of the board. There's like a variety of maps that have slightly different rules that make sort of it more challenging or sort of vary up the tricks and stuff. It was like a super great party game, because I'd played very little Bomberman style game. I had just played that the sort of Bomberman clone, the Atomic Punk game at Galloping Ghost. And so I don't know, like I think it is the antithesis of that like Mario Party thing, because it's they're actually skill based and like meaningful game, little mini games, but the games go really fast. And everybody, even if you're losing, you're still having fun. Like, it was just neat. It was like, I thought it was like a really, really great party game.
The mini games in Mario Party are meaningful and skill based. It's the meta game. It's the meta game where it really starts to make me rage.
I see. Okay. Yeah. So that was it. That was the other game that I wanted to mention.
Cool. Kevin, what's in the news?
Well, let's see here. Dishonored has been selling really, really well, like way beyond their expectations. So it will become a new franchise is the plan.
That makes me super happy, because I'm looking forward to the point at which I decide that series has jumped the shark and I can... I can finally get a chance to feel that betrayal that followers of major video game series seem to enjoy experiencing so much.
Are you gambling on the fact that you'll get two or three good games out of it before that happens?
Yeah, well, I mean, I already got one, so that's, you know, that's really more than I deserve.
they're launching some DLC on December 11th, so that's something that you can look forward to.
Seems like it's just a bunch of, like, time trial... It's like scenarios rather than like a continuation of the story.
I see.
You can't really continue the story. I mean, in a way, future entries in the Dishonored series are going to have nothing to do with the characters in Dishonored. But, I guess it really wraps it up. Like, the ending of Dishonored is like, well, here's what happens for the rest of time. So it's like... I mean, there could be, like, a flashback, I guess, or, like, this is what happened before you gained all your powers. Remember that time you gained a bunch of different powers and then forgot about them prior to the beginning of the first game in the series? I hope that future games in that series are different dudes with different sets of abilities, and maybe not even stealth games. I hope that Dishonored 2 is just chess. reskinned with whales.
Okay.
Anyway.
And it's just nice to see like the idea of new IP being successful in an environment when a lot of publishers are being like, we only want to do new IP if there's a new platform. You know, which is sort of a sentiment that's going around. Like, they're like a lot of publishers are holding off on doing any new major intellectual property strains until the next generation of consoles or something, right? Like,
but guys, the Wii U. That's everybody needs to bank on that.
Yeah,
because that seems like it's going to be really important and really successful.
There's apparently releasing the Wii Mini in a couple weeks, too, or whatever, which, I don't know, it's like the small version of the PlayStation or PlayStation 2 or whatever. I don't know why that's exciting to anyone, because it's not, I didn't feel like the Wii was large.
Yeah, my primary problem with it is that it was too heavy.
Right? Like, I don't get that at all. Did you guys follow the Oculus Rift Kickstarter at all when that was a thing?
No.
No.
It was, I mean, I don't know if you've heard of it. It is like a pair of goggles that's going to be like immersive 3D virtual reality style gameplay or whatever. And they were hoping to get developer kits out by December, but the response to their Kickstarter was so strong that they had to sort of ramp up production, and they're going to be released in March. But it sounds like people are pretty excited about the possibilities with that thing. So
wait, are they're saying it's delayed because they got too much money?
Yeah. Well, because they went from expecting to make
too many units
to 7,500 units, right? Like,
yeah. I got the feeling that their intention was to use this Kickstarter as a way to help them get dev kits out, and a lot of consumers did not realize that these were not intended to be the consumer model.
Right.
And I think that is the key to the problems they're having, is they didn't emphasize that, you know, if you're not a developer, if you're just a consumer, you should wait and not get this particular one.
They should have had Steve Ballmer do their Kickstarter video.
Oh, then nobody would have won one.
Yeah, I saw a cool video about a Disney manufactured robot that uses the Kinect system to play catch with people. So Kinect is like tracking the player, the human movements and the balls, like the brightly colored balls, and then it uses that data to actually maneuver in space and catch and toss a ball and stuff like that. And then they like, and I thought, okay, that's kind of interesting. But then they did these like subtle little things which just made it kind of awesome, which I think is what makes Disney is like, when the robot misses, it like has
it
a
yells it, fuck.
Right. It'll do like a couple of different random noise. A couple of random animation things where it'll be like, it'll shrug its shoulders, or it'll like look down at the ground where the ball was, or look behind it if the ball went past it. And it, like, it just makes it, all of a sudden, it like makes it seem like a living thing.
It totally like, pulls out a rubber Abraham Lincoln mask and puts it on.
Yeah.
Sorry, America.
And then the only other news item that I saw that sort of caught my eye was that, there is a tattoo artist that is suing the game developer THQ for reproducing tattoo artwork on a human that they modeled for like a UFC like fighting game. And it's interesting because tattoo artists apparently maintain the copyright to the tattoos that they put on people, right? So like, if Joe Schmo licenses his likeness for a video game, he does not actually have the rights to license the tattoos on his body with that likeness.
Okay, so all right, so here's a thorny situation. Steve-O has a tattoo on his back of a photograph of himself. Who owns that? Does he own that as the person who has the tattoo? Does he own it as the person depicted in the photograph? Does the photographer own it? Or does the tattoo artist own it?
Yeah.
Well, all right, let's quick. Let's make a video game with Steve-O as the protagonist and see who sues us.
And then we can
make American
some
video
sort of
game playing public.
Some concert based on the video game and a movie about the making of the video game and the concert that ensues. Yeah, like you can go down that rabbit hole. It's interesting to see this sort of very fringe copyright argument going on. Did you guys, you don't look at Facebook at all. I think either of you. So you probably missed the whole like spate of a bunch of people posting to Facebook that they actually own the copyright to everything that they've put on there, which was just some sort of weird meme that was going around for a day or two.
I mean, my tattoo is copyrighted art. It's a Xerox out of a Sam and Max comic book, and as I know Steve Purcell is okay with it. I've shown it to him a couple of times.
He got it back. He found out I was your boss, and so he stole $10 from me.
But I mean, the tattoo artist, when I went to get it, he didn't even blink.
Yeah.
Well, if he didn't recognize it, well, I must have been a really like. Did he have somebody putting eye drops in him? Like, because that's a big tattoo. If he didn't blink the whole time he was doing it, I'm really amazed it looks as good as it does.
He had to keep his eyes open to focus. I mean, you wouldn't want to. He blinks, you know, that needle might go anywhere,
right.
You know?
Right. That's why Sam looks like a cactus.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's Sam or Max. I'm terrible at LucasArts games. Huh. Well, I think in that case, it should have been illegal for you to get that tattoo without Steve Purcell's permission. It probably was technically illegal for you to do it, right? Like, because I can't. Oh man, did you see? So there is this print-on-demand outfit that is just binding Wikipedia articles and selling them on Amazon.
On Amazon, I've seen that.
Right, and there is one that is about our video game, but it's just the Wikipedia article about Kingdom of Loathing and a bunch of other related linked articles with like that are all fucked up because it's all automated. And like, I don't think there's anything you can do to stop that because Wikipedia is explicitly, it is because Wikipedia like explicitly releases all of its stuff into the public domain. Right.
I thought it was Commons license where it was like attribution is required and stuff like.
Well, but even if it is, I mean, all they have to do is attribute it to Wikipedia, right? Like, as I understand it, there's nothing anyone can do about this.
I wonder if they're making any money. Like, I wonder if people are buying those things.
I don't know. I mean,
because like a savvy consumer,
I bought it. I want a book about my game. I'll pay $20 for a printout of some Wikipedia articles.
I just donated $20 to Wikipedia.
I won't actually pay that. Yeah. I could just print out the source code and bind it. What was I going to say? You shouldn't have been able to get that tattoo, right? In a lot of ways, who fucking cares whether you have a tattoo of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles or Mickey Mouse or whatever?
What happens if the moment that they pull the Wikipedia article down to do the bookbinding, it's all been replaced with Edgar Allan Poe is a fag?
Homosexual.
Yeah,
Edgar Allan Poe is a homosexual.
Kevin, don't be crass. Edgar Allan Poe is a homosexual. Wikipedia doesn't tolerate the kind of bullshit that you just said.
do they have any kind of like quality control on that kind of
I'd
stuff?
Like you to read my new ebook, The Creamy Cock Chronicles. Here is the creamy cock in orbit around Betelgeuse in the constellation Orion. 510 million light years from Earth. God, everybody fucking go look at the Wikipedia article for certs.
Yeah.
Because.
And then look at the talk page.
Yeah, shit, look at the history. God. Oh, man, the internet. Sometimes it's so good. Ugh. That's a weird thing, though. Like, I would. So if I draw. If I were to go in to a tattoo artist with a picture of some KOL artwork and say, I want this tattooed on me, would the tattoo artist suddenly own the copyright to that image because he put it on me? Or just the copy of it that is on my skin? So he could only prove violation in the instances where it was clearly reproduced from the one that was on my skin and not the original.
I mean, what if I use my phone to take a snapshot of your computer monitor that has Kingdom of Loathing on it?
No. I guess, I mean, part of this is because I am a white plutocrat business owner, but I feel like the fairly reasonable way to approach creative work that is done for a wage is that it is owned by the person that pays you the wage. unless you stipulate otherwise. Yeah. Right, and that seems to be like at least the anecdotes that I know about, like, say, Star Wars, where it's like, all right, well, we'll either give you $500 or 0.5% of the money that this movie makes. And right. some of the people said, oh, I'll take $500. And then 10 years later, they were like, fuck. And then some of the people said, oh, I'll take 0.5%. And then a year later, they were like, woo. Right? But it's not like, yeah.
I mean, it I think it depends on the contracts, right? Like, if it is not specified, I'm pretty sure that everything, all the copyrights reside with the person that created it, right? The moment that it was... the photograph was taken, or the words were written down, or the art was drawn. Unless they
that seems like a weird. I mean, I guess there are a lot of universes in which the version of me that exists in those universes thinks, oh yeah, that's a totally fair default. Of course, the person that makes something owns what they make. But like, I sure as shit don't feel that way about like the car horns that my aunt makes in the car horn factory. So what, like. Why is a song that I write categorically different than a hamburger that a guy that works at Wendy's makes? Right? I mean, Wendy's or the Car Horn Factory are providing the raw materials that are being assembled by a person there, but like, it's...
because they are not arranging the bun and meat or plastic... and
well, okay, so let's say Subway, a place that actually has sandwich artists.
Right. Okay, so that's so like that. I could imagine them creating a new sandwich and being like, you know, I own the copyright to this sandwich, which I don't think that's a real thing.
And then they can sue everyone who eats it.
But you know, yeah, like what? Where do recipes fall in the whole intellectual property? Like,
oh man, recipes are totally disruptive, man. That's like a set of 3D printer plans for a gun. God, I cannot fucking wait until that becomes a commonplace enough thing that I can read arguments about it on the internet.
Recipes?
No, 3D, like...
that's already a
easily accessible, feasible 3D printing of guns. I cannot wait for the cognitive dissonance that occurs in people who are like, information wants to be free, guns want to be illegal.
There is a Metafilter thread recently about a gun, some specific part of the gun that you can buy a thing that is 80% useful as a gun and go to a milling machine and crank it out the rest of the way. And
I mean, that's always been... I mean, that's the problem with... writing real specific laws, right? Is that there's always way. Well, so like, we don't want to make a certain kind of gun illegal in a way that makes like toy guns illegal. So, well, this is a toy. It just happens to be a really expensive toy that is mostly like this gun, and all it takes is a nail of a particular size and shape to turn it into a real gun. Mm-hmm. Hey, have you heard about our sister company, Amalgamated Nails Incorporated? We sell a nail that you might be interested in. It's only $40. Or it's only 10 cents. I mean, and I think that like... not to get into like a gun control argument, but it gets real weird when you start trying to make particular objects illegal and write rigid definitions of objects, right? Because like, well, laws are real good for encouraging people to skirt them. Like hovercraft. Hovercraft are also real good for encouraging people to skirt them.
Yeah.
Well, that's the news. Guns and tattoos. Hey, so this assignment.
Full throttle.
Woo!
Full throttle indeed. So I couldn't do it. I played maybe an hour of it, and then I was like, yeah. And I read a long document that was at the LP archive, which I thought was named that just because they stored all of their data on giant racks of LP ROMs, but it turns out it's the Let's Play archive.
Huh.
So I read a document that was basically like a walkthrough with hundreds and hundreds of screenshots of Full Throttle. I am sad about this because Full Throttle is one of those games that I have constantly heard was really good, and I was like, this it occupied some of the same space in my head as Super Metroid, where it was like, all right, this is a thing that someday I will play for the first time, and I will get to have the experience of playing this game for the first time that so many enthusiastic fans of this game wish that they could have again. But, like, I found nothing in this game to like.
Man.
Really?
Yeah.
I was very angry at this game in several places, but I thought that the story and the...
Yeah, the story and the voice acting,
is pretty good.
Characters are all fantastic.
The voice acting is pretty good. The characters, like, I don't know. I thought about this a lot. I thought about this a lot today. Like, I can identify with the old man who owns the motorcycle company.
Yeah.
Right. That is a character that I was like, hey, that's the good guy in this story. But the protagonist, it's like, if the protagonist had done everything that he did over the course of the game and had not been introduced as a member of a motorcycle gang, then it is possible that I would have thought, ah, sweet, like a badass. That's a guy. I could be that guy. I can identify with that guy. But
you
like,
just can't identify with somebody in a motorcycle gang?
No. I mean, I can't, like, I just, and I think it in a lot of ways, I feel like this made me think about, like, all right, so what is wrong with my approach to things that I was okay with the protagonist of Vice City, but not with the protagonist of San Andreas or the protagonist of this game? And I think it is because the cruel criminal organization that the protagonist of Vice City belongs to is an imaginary thing. It is a thing that I have never heard any real stories about them killing people in the real world that I live in. Because the, like, fictionalized movie version of the mafia is, I think, probably not, like, a significant thing in the real world. Maybe it is, but that is a thing that I am capable of romanticizing to some extent, whereas inner-city Los Angeles gangs in the 90s are a thing that you see on TV because a bunch of people got killed, right? And motorcycle gang, like, my association with motorcycle gangs is, oh, yeah, they beat their wives a lot.
Huh.
I mean, this is like, a weird, like, future world where there's hover cars and motorcycles have 12 tailpipes and, like, the desert is somehow full of...
Sure.
Nothing but motorcycles and semi-trucks.
I mean, so it sets them up as the kind of people that would beat you up if you went into a bar where they were and you couldn't relate to them on their level, right? That is the introduction to your character, is you vandalize somebody's car, right? And then you are a dangerous element that some depicted characters have to approach. Right. And he says to the guy that you hate, right, the guy that is clearly the villain of the story, he says, don't go in there. It's not safe for you to go in there if you're not one of them.
Right.
And the reason is because they're bad guys. The only reason that it is ever not safe for you to go into a building that is full of some dudes is if those dudes are bad guys. And so right off the bat, the fucking bad guys.
I mean, is that not also explainable by the fact that these guys are going to recognize this corporate guy as a villain?
Okay,
I
but,
mean,
okay,
if
but,
any,
but see,
any
here's
random
the thing.
Joe off the street, would they necessarily be as angry about towards this guy who they know and hate?
If there is any person on Earth who you would beat up because of the way that they looked when they walked into a bar that you were in, you are the fucking bad guys. That is my story. Whether, like, if fucking Osama bin Laden walked into a bar that I was in, I would be like, whoa, what the fuck? How are you still alive?
I don't think we're talking about a total stranger in this instance, though. These motorcycle guys know that this is a
quality do they know Ripburger?
I think they know who Ripburger is, yeah.
I don't know. This is a niggle. I'm trying to figure out why. Like,
so is it super important for you to be able to identify with the protagonist, with the main character that much that it like drives you away from playing the game? If you can't,
I think it's important. I think it's important for me not to dislike them.
I mean, yeah. I mean, I certainly had that problem with Final Fantasy VIII of hating every character and therefore not being able to play it.
I mean, it's the danger that you have when you assign personality to a main character.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And I mean, I think you can, God, fuck, you guys need, I forgot earlier that I finished the Walking Dead games.
Oh, yeah, I need to play that. I think I'm saving that for something to do over Christmas break.
Okay, I really need for you guys to play this so that we can issue a spoiler warning and talk about it on this podcast, mm-hmm. because it, fuck. So, like, the main character of that is large, like, he, you know, you are at least given a sense of, like, a conflicted past. Right, mm-hmm. Like he is set up as kind of a bad guy, but you learn over the course of it that there were extenuating circumstances to him having been a bad guy, and you know maybe there was some unfair treatment that led to the place where he was. But like, I don't know. Like maybe if there had ever been a period of time in my life where I was capable of like romanticizing a motorcycle gang, mm-hmm. it would be different.
Did you read the haiku at the end of the credits?
Yeah. I can't necessarily like 100% make this like claim that this thought is valid or not, but I think it's just as likely as the proposition that this is a gang of violent thugs that people know not to go into that bar because these guys are criminals, as the fact that, I mean, that maybe these are just some like rough and tumble guys and don't take shit from anybody, but are generally decent. And the warning that the other corporate guy gives Ripburger not to go in there is prejudice on his part.
Yeah, and that's definitely true, right? I'm thinking about like other adventure games in the past, and like the main characters that you are controlling or playing as, and I'm not sure that I'm particularly inclined to be sympathetic or identifying with them. Like I'm, you know, like a space janitor or like a dude who wears polyester suits and tries to sleep with all the ladies all the time. You know,
well,
like,
but those people are those characters, and like to a similar extent, Guybrush Threepwood and Bob and Threadbare, they are like dopey caricatures, mm-hmm. right? They're right. Schlubs, and that like they are calculated to be maximally identifiable with, right? Huh. Like strong. Character, because even I think even in the King's Quest games, like you're never like, well, you know, do you really even speak in those games? I mean, that like the Not Sierra really. The Sierra games especially, like they'll spend a little bit of time on some character work in the very beginning, but like they are not nearly as character driven as LucasArts games,
right?
Right? And I don't know. You know, I think, like, if a Sam and Max game was just the psychopathic rabbit, it would be really hard to stomach. And it is that there is a good guy, balancing it out. And it's like, it's not that Ben is a bad guy. It's that he's a criminal. You know what I mean? You're just like,
he's a criminal in what's apparently a pretty totalitarian future dystopia state. He's a rebel.
The first set of puzzles is just you stealing shit, and some of it is from the man, but some of it is from this fucking welder guy who has never given you any reason not to like him, and some of it is from the guy that stole something.
Did
the welder steal something from the? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. You're right.
He stole the torch from the.
Yeah. Maureen. Okay. Okay. Fair enough. So then the junkyard guy, what did he do?
It's the same guy. Doug is the
okay, well, guy. Fine. Maybe they thought of this. Maybe I should read this more carefully. Okay. I mean, well, sure. So then they do go out of their way to make it so you're not, apart from your screen entrance being a needless and willful vandalism of somebody's car, just because you assume that because they're in a nice car that you don't like them. Hmm. Right? And it turns out, oh man, I just totally fucked up the limo of the guy that made this motorcycle that I really love, and like the one guy left in this fucked up world that I respect, but I didn't apologize. Because whatever. My primary problem with this game was not a failure to identify with the characters or a problem with the story or whatever. Because I think, like, if I would watch this, I would watch this as a movie, and I would think about it. Like, I would think, like, all right, well, who's the good guy in this movie? And like,
there were very few things where you actually had a lot of control. Like, it was more movie than game, in my opinion. Like, there were definitely portions where you were given a task, and it was like, here, act out this like menial task, and then we'll have another like 30-second or 5-minute cutscene or whatever. And then there were some stretches where you were like more autonomous, but it was like, get these three things in whichever order you want.
Yeah, it's like, here, have some autonomy. Sorry, the only thing you're going to be able to do with this autonomy is some video game bullshit.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, this is adventure game.
Yeah. So. I did not realize how late this game came out. Like, it was like 95. Mm. Huh. So I think that there are two Tim Schafers.
Wow, was it really 95?
Yeah, 95.
I was already graduated from high school in 95.
Yeah, you were. So there is the game and the Brutal Legend Tim Schafer. And then there is the Grim Fandango and Psychonauts and everything that's come out of Double Fine Tim Schafer. So there's like Whimsy Tim Schafer and Look at This Badass Shit Tim Schafer. And I think I prefer Whimsy Tim Schafer. Or as I call him, Timsy Schafer.
I was confused as to why this would be your choice of story, right? I followed along and I played the game and I got all the way through it. But the whole time I was thinking, really? These are the choices you're making? This is an interesting, weird choice. I think the guy kind of looks a little bit like an idealized Tim Schafer. I think Ben is the protagonist.
No, certainly. Sure.
I hadn't thought of that before, but sure.
So I'm wondering how much of this is like him just like, I'm interested in these things, and I'm going to like tell a story about stuff that I think is cool, even if it doesn't have resonance with as many other people, you know.
I really hated the graphics.
Really?
Also.
Really?
I think that they were probably based on some cool paintings, but they were scans of paintings rather than like crafted pixel art. And a lot of it was like fucking modeled like 3D modeled and then rendered to 320 by 280. I don't think that's the right resolution.
I don't really have
like
a good memory of
so much of it. So much of it was just like Donkey Kong Country bullshit happening in the cutscenes. Also, fuck that fucking motorcycle fighting game.
Oh my god! In the like that whole section where you were like getting different weapons. Fuck that shit.
I didn't even play that. I just read about that and it pissed me off.
Oh my god! It was worse. It was so much worse than reading about it.
There's a trick you can use to bypass a lot of it, but yeah, if you don't find that, it is kind of a pain in the ass. I will definitely give you that.
Oh my god.
Using the fertilizer you can get is basically an instant kill on anybody except for the cave fish.
No. I spent a lot of time trying to use that fucking fertilizer on people, and it does not work on everybody.
It works on the woman with the chainsaw. I read that.
Yeah. Eventually. Like because I had failed using it against so many guys, I just stopped trying to. And, like, you have to use it against her to get the chainsaw, which you then have to use. Like, that starts a chain. There were, like, those four guys that I could not fucking beat because I had written off the fertilizer as a way to do anything. Oh, my God. It was such a pain. Like, I was so angry that it was not designed such that once you got a weapon that dude stopped showing up. But, like, there are, like, 8 or 10
guys. That is definitely the worst part of the game. Yeah.
It was...
doing the single fight that you have to do in the beginning, where it's just punch and kick, I kept... Like, my initial conclusion was like, oh, well, my punches aren't connecting because I'm clearly fucking behind this dude instead of up next to him. How do I move forward? But you can't move forward. All you can do is move left and right, and then when you get all the way over to the right, you can click and tab out of the fucking scum VM window because to get over to the right, your mouse is on fucking Chrome in the background. So it's like, what porn? What? This isn't part of the game. Oh, I tabbed out of scum VM. Yeah. And I mean, I guess, you know, you would have only had one monitor, and you would have been playing it full screen when it was made. But still, man, the propensity of a lot of... The problem with that minigame is that its presentation was too nice, right? They took a cool-looking scene and grafted a game onto it, as opposed to making a minigame and then creating an interface that makes it clear what the fuck is going on. Yeah, and like, this is like exactly why I stopped playing The Dig. You get to this goddamn thing in The Dig where you are manipulating this crystal crane thing that moves in three dimensions, except they decided, oh, wouldn't it be a sweet artistic angle if we did this at a fucking like 30 degree angle off of true. So you just have no fucking idea where anything is relative to anything else, and it's fucking impossible.
I spent 15 minutes dropping cars on a fucking dog. I don't know if you got that far.
I did. That was at the point where I was just reading a walkthrough and doing what the walkthrough said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I spent 15 minutes trying to kill the dog by dropping cars on him, and like you would drop a car on the dog, and it would like shake the car around, and then he would like pop out, and I'm like, seriously?
I would never have gotten there, I don't think. Well, I might have, but I would never have been able to finish that if I hadn't looked at a walkthrough because I missed the hose the garage. So if you didn't have the hose. And also, it never would have occurred to me to like go back behind that thing where the guys can't see you.
I figured that one out. Without any, like, there were two or three points where I had to consult a walkthrough because I was just getting too frustrated. But like that one, I managed to figure out. I was like, why can I go back here? I guess I'll try it after touching the ladder because it gives you some time to walk around. Like, it was very meta game. I did not figure that out in the context of like playing the game and thinking of that as a solution. I was like, okay, why is this designed this way? I was thinking of it from the designer point of view instead of a player point of view. And I was like, well, there's probably some fucking reason. And
the fact that that's one of those things where it's like, all right, you've got a few seconds to try something and then watch some cutscenes and then go do the same thing again to like reset the game state to the point where you can start experimenting with it. And it's like, for the sake of dramatic storytelling, I can see why you would do that. But like, man, I think this is one of those games that if I had been 12 years old when I was playing this game for the first time, I might have had the patience for it, and I might look back on this as like a marvel of what video games could be. But as it is, I'm just like, fuck this game, man.
It had good like mood, and the setting was, you know, interesting, but it definitely has some flaws for sure. Something that I wondered was, so like there was a hint line associated with this game, and I wondered, like, were games designed with, you know, before the advent of the internet, with these like call in per, you know, pay per minute hint lines, were they designed with those in mind, with some obtuse puzzles such that people would call in because they were
accused video games of doing now to sell the strategy guides?
Yeah.
Well, it's less of a reasonable accusation now because every bit of information is for free on the internet. I mean, I think that they weren't. I don't think there was anything sinister about it. I just think that, like, adventure games are very tricky because what seems like an obvious solution to a puzzle to you is going to require a flash of insight that to any other person playing is going to be some sort of random amount of distance between what they think is reasonable, you know. Right. And
yeah,
honey on the cat hair.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, that's a bad example, but like there are just like, yeah, I don't know. I've always been really terrible at adventure games, and so I don't have a lot of legs to stand on in this because I just, you know, I don't have the patience to like go around and click on everything and rub everything against every other thing. And this Full Throttle played like there were a lot of things in it that reminded me of modern Telltale games, and I think that that's not at all surprising given that Telltale is made up of people who made these games and people who grew up playing these games.
I mean, Dave Grossman, you know, was a writer for Full Throttle.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
but like, I think the modern The Walking Dead, there are some little puzzles in it here and there, but there's never any place that you're just stuck trying to do some obtuse bullshit. Like you try some stuff, you interact with some systems, you figure out how they work, and then you have some like conversations that are not so much puzzles as like ways of permanently altering the relationships between characters and seeing how that works. And there's you quickly get to the realization that there's not really any, every way through this is equally wrong, right? Like you can, you know, you guys need to play it.
Yeah, it's on my list. It's at the top of my list.
I mean, it's weird. You could have presented the Walking Dead game in the 90s as a like full motion video choose your own adventure CD-ROM and it would be a laughing stock. But for whatever reason, like either because it's so well written and so well voice acted, or because it is just abstracted enough that it doesn't seem hokey, you know, and it is just interactive enough that it doesn't feel like a movie, that it is just this fucking sublime thing. Ugh, man. You guys gotta play it and not Full Throttle.
What?
I'll definitely play it over Christmas.
The knife fight, not the knife fight, the knife hand mini game in Full Throttle at all?
No, I read about it.
Why is it in the game?
It's like an Easter egg, right? I mean, it's
just a thing.
I was stuck for so long because I thought that I had to somehow do something with that to proceed, and like I just did not know what, like I was because I had forgotten that there was that like screen behind the bar where I could look for some additional information or whatever. I was just stuck because that was the only thing that I hadn't like fully explored, and spent a good half hour I think trying to like, okay, well, maybe if I cut off all my fingers, you know, or something, like maybe that'll. I was like, I just had no fucking idea. It was like I couldn't attack the guy because he had a knife, and then all of a sudden I've got the knife, but I can't get off this mini game screen without giving him back the knife, and I'm like, what the fuck, you know, like it was just super super aggravating. There were a bunch of places in the game too where like I would click on something and it'd be like, oh, I'm gonna save that for this other thing that I've never heard of. And I'm like, okay. You know, like they weren't particularly careful about divulging
character knowledge. Yeah.
There
were a lot of in the like Let's Play thing that I read, there were a lot, like they would point it out every time Ben just magically knew somebody's name because he moused over them in the interface.
Yeah.
Man, I watched a video of the Demolition Derby minigame. That looked like some fucking bullshit.
Yeah, until I realized that I could play with the keyboard, I was really pissed.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, could you do the motorcycle fights with the keyboard too?
I couldn't find keys that worked. So that one, I was that was angry.
That was still in the days when people, like, not everybody had a mouse. Yeah. It was the latter days of that, but like, because I played Loom. I played Loom with the keyboard originally.
Huh. How did you select objects and stuff?
You move the cursor around with the arrow keys.
Oh, wow. That's rough.
Yeah.
Huh. Did Loom have any bits that were, like, super time sensitive at all?
No, I don't think so.
Yeah, because, like,
there wasn't a lot of, like, tense. That's another way in which this reminds me of the more modern Telltale games. Like, there's a whole section of the Back to the Future game where you're, like, on the outside of a car that's driving down the highway and you're, like, scooting around on the edge of it and stuff. And it seems like a lot of, like, real action-y segments in Full Throttle, which is cool. Yeah. But no, Loom, I mean, there was the, you know, you had to eavesdrop on Mandible and the guy in the forge so that they would yell something at the blacksmith so that he would hold the sword up so that you could target it and there would be quiet for you to cast a spell. But that gave you, you know, 15 seconds to do that.
Right.
And it was repeatable indefinitely.
Yeah.
Huh. I mean, that was the thing. Like, I think the reason that I like Loom so much is because it just didn't do any video game bullshit, you know? It just was like...
So something else that I wanted to talk about was the layout of the screens and the maps and that kind of thing. Like, so like not remembering or not noticing that I could go behind the bar, I felt like it was a default in the game and the interface way more than it was a problem that I had. Cause like, I thought back about the Sierra Quest games where by and large, the screens were arranged in a grid. Right.
Yeah.
And, like, in Loom, it was generally not that confusing because there would be obvious paths on and off screen. But, like, in the Glass City, it was really hard to tell where the fuck you could go and where you couldn't because it was, like, it wasn't clear which things were pathways and which things weren't and where entrances and exits led and went to and stuff like that. And that was kind of frustrating. And I don't know, like... having these dramatic camera angles makes for sort of more interesting artwork, but it takes away from your ability to interact with the world as you would if you actually were that character where you could see what the hell was going on from your perspective, right? Like, and I don't know where the happy medium from those two things could be, you know? I mean, maybe first person shooters that have, or first person perspective games that just have really nice environments is where the answer to that is. But
yeah, I don't know. Because I mean, once you're developing 3D assets, I mean, you can, you know, they can just look like what they are, as opposed to having to be right. Like limit where the player can go to the angles from which you've had somebody paint this castle.
Yeah.
You know? But yeah, I mean, I felt like Full Throttle did an okay job of that because you could always just mouse all around the screen and see where it turned into that red arrow to tell you that you could go there.
Yeah. I did not notice that the arrow pointing behind the bar was different from the one pointing into the bar in that particular case.
Yeah, okay. I mean, they're different shapes. Yeah, when you're in Melon Weed or whatever, when you're out on the map, if you get the arrow cursor and then double click, it just teleports you there and doesn't make you watch the little guy walk across the map, which was pretty nice of them. Yeah, I mean that saves you. I mean, depending on how long it takes you to solve the puzzles, that saves you anywhere from 30 seconds to an hour, I guess.
Right.
But I was pleased to see that somebody thought of that.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it sucks. I mean, I think this is probably where a lot of people stop listening to the podcast because we didn't like a classic.
Full Throttle. I like it. I will still put it in the top three of
LucasArts
games.
Well, you guys
can
listen to Riff's solo podcast.
Along with, I'm not sure, I'm not entirely sure as where I would rank it among Sam and Max and Night of the Tentacle, but those are definitely my top three.
Huh. What about Day of the Tentacle, that game that actually exists?
Oh, is it Day of the Tentacle? No. Okay. Well, that one then.
Actually, I think it was Night of the Nine-Tickle. So our next assignment, Kevin has suggested the NES game Life Force, because it's a game that we can play in like a half an hour, and we got shit to do. Yeah. Although Kevin tried playing it and said, quote, it's hard.
It is hard.
And that's because Kevin doesn't have the game memorized yet. You will, buddy. You will. So that's what we're going to do for the next assignment. NES Life Force. I don't know what. Go to the store and buy it, I guess.
Yeah.
Go to. So find a portal to 1989. Find a Walmart, maybe, and buy Life Force. I don't know if they have it at Walmart.
I was going to suggest buying a sports almanac, but I guess it doesn't work in that direction, does it?
You meant a sports bra.
Oh,
okay. That's something they would have. Well, I don't know. Had the sports bra been invented in 1989? I'm sure that it had. You could get some wrist warmers.
Sure.
Some sweatbands. Some leg bands. Can't get any silly bands, though. You could take silly bands back and say, you should invest in these.
If people want to play the MAME version of it and comment on the differences between that and the NES port, I think that'd also be okay.
Huh. Okay.
It was
Kevin.
Called Salamander originally in Japan when it was released or something.
That's weird.
Only in North America is it called Life Force.
It didn't have anything to do with the movie Life Force. That's to be certain.
Sure. That's true. If people wanted to contact us and ask us questions,
yeah,
we would not answer.
That's what I was about to. That's what I was about to ask you, buddy.
Well, they could tweet at us at VGHotDog. They could email us VGHotDog@gmail.com, or they could check out our website, which has a link to our forums at VideoGamesHotDog.com. And if they want to make us happy, they could check out our podcast on iTunes and give us some stars and review us. Not that that will ever have any impact on where we are in the rankings because of some imaginary bullshit that we don't understand.
Hooray!
Yeah, if you work at Apple in the Department of Imaginary Bullshit, give us a call. Let us know what we're doing wrong.
So confusing.
Until then, stay tuned for the next charming and delightful episode of Video Games Top Dog. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.